New Music Means New Project. This fall, the National Building Museum is bringing together leading Black voices in design, art, and architecture for Intersections, a series of dynamic discussions about culture, equity, and representation through the lens of design. Launching September 16th and running through December 14th, Intersections engages nationally recognized Black architects, designers, and artists in conversations focused on social justice in the built environment. Through interactive lectures and hands-on workshops, the series is designed to provoke new thinking, spark conversation, enlighten, and empower. In partnership with the National Building Museum in Washington, D.C., Architecture's Political Podcast will dive deeper into some of the topics as well as presenters stemming from this phenomenal series, Intersections. In case you're not from the area, let me tell you a little bit about the National Building Museum. Since it was created in 1980 through an act of Congress, the National Building Museum has transformed the public's understanding of the impact of architecture, engineering, landscape architecture, construction, planning, and design. Through exhibitions, educational programs, and special events, the National Building Museum welcomes visitors of all ages to experience stories about the built world and its power to shape lives, communities, and our future. Links to the Intersection series is in the show notes of each episode, which includes registration that's both in-person and virtual. So check it out. When this podcast first started back in January 2020, I had no idea of the life-changing events, the protests, George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. We, the architectural profession, and others as well, awakening. And I started to see famous Black and brown people in this industry being asked the same question over and over and over again. What do you think? How can we fix this? And so my feeds got proliferated with podcasters and news articles and statements, firm leaders, large and small, asking the Black and brown community how to fix it. So when I got an opportunity to talk to Dr. Maple Wilson, I would have never asked her any of these questions. As a matter of fact, I started off the interview with saying, you know, she's been well documented and a genuine concern about her mental health and is a genuine concern about all the Black and brown people who does these social justice activities. How is your mental health? And I want to encourage people who do talk to these amazing and courageous individuals who face evils every single day. How the hell are you? What is it that I can do for you? Because I felt that during that time, it was an extraction of their knowledge for them to be the teacher to educate all. And those individuals, those students who invited them on their platforms, sit there and take notes and do absolutely nothing with this information. I was concerned. I know me, and it was difficult for me. I don't consider my platform as a social justice platform. The stuff that I do, the stuff that I am focusing on, and it's not about how I could create an anti-racist. I don't think I have that power. I'm certainly here more or less educate myself and take you guys along the journey. I do want to solve the housing problem. That would be great if I could do that. But that benefits all. We talked about Atlanta, the series. If you guys haven't watched it, you need to watch it, especially this season. The last couple of seasons followed a storyline, but this one was different. And he took a unique approach to it. That's what I appreciate Black and brown creatives. Because we take something, we observe it, or experience it, the same thing. And we articulated in an artistic way. And sometimes you have to do that because when you're blunt about it, people may get desensitized. But when you say it in a creative way, it leads to interpretation. On my previous episode, I mentioned Maple with Dr. Hazel Edwards and just how academics and research really is a really powerful tool to understand yourself as well as the environment around you. And one thing I appreciate her, Dr. Wilson, is when I asked her, is history repeating itself? And her answer was very profound to me because it takes it to another level. Hope you guys enjoy it. Here you go. Dr. Maple Wilson?
That is correct.
For the past couple of months since your talk and just in general and just in life, you're well documented. And I was trying to think of questions to ask you that hasn't been already asked. I mean, through lectures, publications, like exhibits, I'm like, how can I make this an interesting conversation that no one else has heard before? I have two or three. Hopefully I nailed it. Let's see how it goes. So your research with anti-Blackness spaces and trauma and the Black and Brown community has experienced, not only in this country, but globally. How is your mental health?
Oh, thank you for that question. I'm tired. It's a lot. I think, you know, I've just been saying this to my students, to colleagues. One, I think the pandemic is still with us. I think we still stress out about getting sick, or if we get sick, do we spread it to others? It's that living with that stress is still tiring. That is playing in the background, I think, for a lot of people. And then I think that living in, you know, just call it what it is, a racist society is exhausting. I mean, it's very tiring. There's a really wonderful opinion piece in the New York Times today by the writer Touré on the end of the season 4 of Atlanta, which is the final season. And one of my colleagues, Emmanuel Admasu, sent it to me and another colleague, because we kind of have this ongoing conversation about Atlanta, precisely because of the way in which it nails the surreality of Blackness. Like, is this real? Not real? Can I trust what I'm seeing? Is this happening? The modern world is supposed to be a world of reason, of justice and law. And if you're Black, you know, that really plays itself out in your life. And yet, all men are created equal, right? And so that dissonance, I think, plays a part in, you know, like the way in which Black people negotiate a world that just isn't made for our being, right? Once we're Blackened, like, it's just like, you're not human. You don't get good housing. You don't get good education. You don't get clean water. You don't get, you know, there's so much that makes it very difficult to survive in a world that is made out of racial logics that come with how modernity forms. And so it's quite frankly a mind fuck. So, how do you, and I think that's the great thing for me about Atlanta. I was like, I don't know. But then I realized, oh, wait, this is surreal. This is kind of how it works. Is this really happening? Am I to believe there's justice for all? I'm an American citizen and I've done nothing. And yet I'm created like a criminal and I could end up dead. Like, yeah, it plays with your head, so to speak. But I think it's good to engage creative works that alert you to that.
And Donald Glover did an excellent job with Atlanta. And I there was an episode where he parried Tyler Perry. Don't remember that.
Kirkwood Chocolate.
Yes. I mean, you're sitting there and you're like, is this him? Like, in the whole grit scene and the voice, and he's like everywhere, you know, it's just, he nailed that perfectly. And it was just another episode too that escapes me right now. But yeah, just a parody on ourselves as well. Like he,
Oh, absolutely.
I
Yeah,
mean,
that's what I think is amazing.
doing this work, do you think you've gotten desensitized in any way? Reading this, researching this, documenting this, how do you not get upset every single time or not allow your blood pressure to not rise?
No, I mean,
Meditation? Yeah.
no, I don't meditate. I've always had an okay workout regime. I've always been able to exercise in some way or walk or, and I do find that that helps, like friends and family. And I do try to balance it. I mean, it's challenging work. I think there are a lot of people out there that are really doing much more difficult mental and physical work. I work in a bit of a bubble. I work in the academy, which isn't to say institutions aren't their own battleground. So, but I do think doing the work has just brought kind of clarity to my experiences in the world. And that's been helpful because I do think addressing the ways in which race and racialization and how it's formed and it's changes over time. It's a very difficult thing to grasp. It's like grasping sand, right? And you experience, we know it's socially constructed and not real. And yet it is very real in the ways in which it determines your life trajectories. And so that's the surreality of it, I think, that it can really play with your sense of self. For me, I think having more clarity and understanding, where that comes from, certainly from a historical perspective, and watching things like Atlanta, reading writers like Nobessie Phillips or Christina Sharp or Zadie Hartnett, and, other people who are contemporaries and having dialogues with them and, working with someone like Mario Gooden. I mean, it's the poet Tanya Foster is a good friend and an interlocutor. It just helps to keep an understanding of this is what I'm experiencing. What do you think? Am I crazy? Not crazy? Should I overreact? Not overreact? And the other thing is, I've also learned that everything, it cannot be a battle. You cannot fight everything. And sometimes people are just people, right? Nobody's perfect. You have to have grace. You have to be able to say, it's okay. Yeah, that's messed up. And sometimes you just keep it pushing and then strategically know when to challenge. And then you can be effective. Because I think if you're reacting all the time, it's like you just wear yourself out and you don't get results when you need them.
Does anything surprise you in all of the things you've witnessed, read,
I'm
experienced?
always surprised by whiteness's ability to just hide itself, its transparency, and to make a world through its vicious inequalities that other people don't see it and don't understand that your opportunity is someone else's misfortune. And I think it's really hard for people who benefit from whiteness or the wages of whiteness or the possessive investment in whiteness. I'm thinking of all the theorizations around whiteness. And I love using the term whiteness because I think it's a position as opposed to a phenotypical marker of race, which we know is not real. Like we're all humans, right? So these markers of so-called racial difference really don't really matter because we are all humans in the end. And for me, you can be Black and be deeply invested in whiteness, just like you can be a woman and deeply invested in patriarchy, right? We know that to be the case. I'm always surprised at how slippery and elusive and violent whiteness is. The backlash is always just relentless. If you identify it and you call it out, it will come after you.
Violence.
The
In
violence,
violence, yeah.
which is how it maintains its order and domination. And make no mistake, but it's not that it's just violence in and of itself. It's violence because it works within capitalism. It's violence because it works within the state and the nation state, right? Through policing. It's violent because it's deeply invested in patriarchy, right? So it's violence is operative through many other valences and not just racial ones.
What's your method of research in relation to the memorial and the slave labors? Like what I there was a presentation I was watching, and it seemed like you started with, is it art? Is it a quote?
there are kind of methods to how you approach things that you work on. There's a concept and then there's how you do the work. I think for me, I have learned, and I do try to teach this to my students, whether I'm teaching design students or PhD students or whatever, whomever. I have a class in African-American research methods, African-American and African diaspora research methods seminar for master's students, Black studies, like how do you do Black studies? And I'm trying to get them to think about their thesis work. And I think for me, when I want to work on something, it's usually something that is like, why is that? Why is that so odd? Why does that proliferate? Why does that exist? What might that mean? The thing that I don't have an immediate answer to, or often it's just something that's strange and perverse and curious. And so I would say all of my work really hinges on that question around, you know, from the first moment I really felt like I was having like research, you know, things that I wanted to research, especially emerging around, you know, Blackness and race, were always these things that just didn't seem to me to compute in a way. When I did my dissertation, I wanted to write on African-American museum movement. By the 1980s, 90s, you had museums in Memphis, one planned in Cincinnati, the Charles Wright in Detroit, talk of a national museum. And I was like, it's interesting that now these museums are being built in places like Memphis, where 40 years ago, you could barely walk the streets of Memphis if you were Black. So what does it mean for Blacks to claim space in cities and tell historical narratives? That to me was interesting. Then when I started to do the research, I was like, I think there is something that has to be earlier. And then I find this thing called a Negro building in Atlanta in 1895. And I'm like, whoa. What? Negro building? What is it? Like, to me, I was just blown away. So I knew my first chapter was in my dissertation was going to look at that. And then I discovered, oh, and Du Bois did this weird exhibit in Paris. But little did I know that the Negro building would have so many important figures involved in its making. Leading up to it, it had to do with Ida B. Wells and her protests at the Chicago Exposition, and that, you know, Du Bois comes to Atlanta just as the Negro building is closing and he starts his Atlanta project. So it's connected to his infographics, and that Du Bois's exhibition travels to a Negro building, and the group that does the Negro building in Jamestown start a national museum movement that then eventually leads to the one in DC. Like, I had no idea that there was this long thread of this involvement, but it had to do with like, huh, it seems odd for Black people to claim space, especially under Jim Crow, when that wasn't possible. And then it just unraveled this amazing history that nobody had bothered to look at.
Wow. Speaking of, let me have to put it in front of my face. It's a postcard of the Negro building. So I framed it. Someone gave it to me. I can't remember who.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, it's just such a weird, interesting site of Black counterpublic debate. And all of these people were involved. But the thing methodologically, right? So you add, well, how do you do it? If you're doing, let's say, archival work, I've discovered like in Black studies, there's all this work around the archive. Like the archive is not going to yield what you think it's going to yield. Mm. Nobody had, I didn't study, but I did American studies. And I had a little bit, I'd taken classes with Robin Kelly. So I had a little inkling about that. But when I went to research, it's like, whoa, this is hard. There aren't really things in it. So I had to be forensic in the ways in which I had to track and trace and connect and find people to see if they had archives, because it wasn't, the mainstream fairs were archives in and of themselves. And all those things get accessioned into the Library of Congress and their books published. But for these Black expositions, there was no place to keep that stuff. You couldn't keep it in archives. Publishing it was not possible because you didn't have the resources and the presses. So you have to adapt different methods to do that and to piece together these narratives, which are hard, which is why, you know, something like critical fabulations that my colleague Saidiya Hartman suggests, imagining what are those histories, are really important. And that's something that kind of is intriguing me now in the work. And I think as we worked on the memorial, it was clear working within a slave archive, there's so much you couldn't know. And yet we had a memorial that was saying, we want to know names. We want to know what people look like. We want to know what they did. But we could know that because the archive, the violence in the archive was precisely that these aren't humans, they're things. So how do you come to terms with the production of history in a context of white supremacy, right? That is the wholesale erasure and dehumanization of Black life. And so it was hard. It was very, very difficult. And then how do you rehumanize an enslaved community so that their descendants and we have a place to connect with their history and their story?
One thing that you previously talked about is remembering. And it's been forever since I've read Toni Morrison's Beloved, like high school. And so a little bit of Googling, it's not used as a verb, but as a noun. And I thought that was quite interesting. I am doing my own research as to where I grew up. And you did the same. And going through the spaces, your spaces that you've experienced initially, versus revisiting them. So you went to UVA, so the time that you were there, and then you came back. Was there anything that you said to yourself, huh, I never knew, or I felt this way, and it's affirming or not affirming?
Yeah. Well, I would just say that my experience at UVA, where you're young. I mean, when I went to college, we were way more in a bubble of things we didn't know because we didn't have access to the internet. Now I think the internet makes histories and knowledge and disinformation more accessible. So I think that kids are far more knowledgeable, which might make them more anxious about these issues than certainly I was. But I was apprehensive about going to school in the so-called South. I'm like, I don't know about Klan and plantations. And I knew something that there had to have been a slave history in that region, certainly at the university, but no one ever talked about it. Even though we knew he had this concubine, Sally Hemings, right? Like that was known. So we knew there were slaves at Monticello, but there were servants. There was no knowledge really of that. And they were just beginning to understand Mulberry Row and review that. But Jefferson was God. And that always just bugged me. And so when Meejin Yoon, who was an amazing collaborator, and reached out and said, do you want to join our team? We're going to go after this job. I had already been kind of working on my exercising my Jefferson ghosts of my architectural education, because I had started this new project looking at race and American civic architecture, specifically the Virginia State House, but not UVA. But I wanted to understand, how did this so-called polymath Jefferson, who writes the Declaration of Independence, the vaunted author of our sense of democracy, he was a governor of Virginia, president of the United States, but he was a slave owner. He had his concubine, who technically raped, and kids. And like, how do you imagine freedom for all men, yet own men as property? And to me, that disavowal paradox is at the heart of why the United States can't fulfill its emancipatory project, because it's never reconciled that disavowal or the violence through which it took the land from indigenous nations. Just hasn't. What happened was not about virtue. It was about vicious, violent theft that went unpunished because the Americans were the law, white Americans were the law. Coming to back to UVA and working on the memorial and seeing that the university was finally wrestling with this truth, and that the students had been the ones to make the university accountable again and again and again, I thought was a really, I just felt very privileged to simply be a part of that, because I felt the memorial was one part of a larger project of this very important institution in the United States coming to terms with its racist history. And UVA, of all places, I got chased by the Klan in my third year at UVA, yeah, which was pretty crazy. And I called my friend Paul, who was my design partner, he's white. And I said, I had to make sure I was not making up this story. And I said, Paul, that me, you, Michael, and Mary Kay get chased by the clown. These are three, you know, they were classmates. We were in the studio together. Did we get chased one night by the Klan downtown? He's like, oh yeah. There were three guys in white hoods who started chasing us one night. We had been out and had a beer at a bar. Wow. So yeah, so my memories of Charlottesville, you know, they're very, very, very complicated, I would say. So working on this project and working with the university and seeing across the board and amazing students and alumni and faculty and staff, working with people in the community or not. There were people who were just like, I don't care. But seeing them come together to say, this is important and this is something the university must do publicly, I thought was an excellent model. And I'm still shocked it happened.
Last question. Do you think history is repeating itself? Or is it a cycle?
I think there's the problem with the way in which the West imagines pastness. So I think that history in and of itself is a problem in terms of, again, what's in the archive and what's not, how history is constructed, privileges certain narratives that then, again, bolster capitalism, bolster patriarchy, bolster the nation state, the state state violence. So as Michelle Roth Triot writes, the past is silent for, you know, peoples of African descent. So I think history in and of itself is a problem. So it's hard. It's interesting when you have to teach a history class, like to constantly keep saying, you have to understand how, and I try to teach my architectural survey to show what is and isn't in the archive, to show what the canon is or it isn't, to show that this history is coming really from a European perspective and what it leaves out, and that inclusion isn't necessarily a project because it simply keeps the categories the same. And so the West always dominates the meaning of something. So I do think just the discipline of history itself has to be scrutinized. Mm-hmm. But I think the repetition of modernity, yeah, I think it's because I don't think the systems of how we've structured social relations around economics, which is capitalism, politics, the nation state, race, which creates the hierarchies of value within that, liberal individualism. Like, I think all of those things have really a condition of living in the world that is not sustainable because we actually are killing the habitat in which we live. And I don't care what your belief is, whatever, if a flood or fire or hurricane or tornado hit, nature doesn't care who or where you live. Mm-hmm. Blizzards and, you know, the climate crisis that we have produced because we cannot control our extractive tendencies and fossil fuel burning and our need for immediate goods and, you know, a group of people who want to make endless money. It's just created an untenable conditions for mm-hmm. our species. And so I don't think there's going to be a lot of repetition of history because we won't be here. No. And so I believe what Sylvia Winters and others argue is that we have to become a different kind of human. Like the project of the West man is a dead, it literally is a dead end. It's going to kill us all, mm-hmm. whether we subscribe to it or not. And this COP27, I think now that's going on in Egypt, I was just listening today. They're just like, well, you know, will that succeed given how many representatives of the fossil fuel industry have basically been there trying to maintain their stranglehold, right, on politicians through deal making and wealth. So, and it's also produced the authoritarianism, just the out of control. I mean, you know, social media is another extractive. It's really been toxic to our social relations. And so I think there are ways of being human that may not be under the West way of defining who we are and what we know.
And this is, you think of these things and I begin with, how's your mental health? And is the apocalypse going on?
You know? I know. No, that's why the weather has been so nice lately. Mm-hmm. You know, people have been saying, oh, it's been so warm, but it's very disconcerting because it's November. And why is it 70 degrees? It's 68 this morning. It's a lot to think about. Let's just hope the efforts to spin it toward these kind of distractions from really who should be held accountable, the ability to make, to build coalitions and solidarity and work together to build other ways of inhabiting our planet just have to happen. And we have to just cut out all the noise, but it's, but it's hard because that noise is, you know, we just walk around with it in our phones and now computers and within our TVs, the media, just an endless barrage, and it shapes people's perception. There's no such thing as reality. Reality is a construct of many things that we get socialized into. And so what media has done, the explosion in media, has just produced multiple realities for people. Mm-hmm. Many fictions, everything's fictional. Our states are fictional. Our money's fiction. It's just, it is what it is because we believe it is what it is.
Yeah, yeah. And in some ways we have to, right?
We have
to. In order for society to function, yeah.
Yeah, we have to earn a wage. We have to be wage earners, essentially, mm-hmm. under capitalism, because we just need to eat. We need a place over our head. But the system has made it untenable that so many people cannot get a house. They're unhoused. What do we do? Instead of answering that problem, we just criminalize the unhoused, which doesn't do anything other than somebody just sees it as an opportunity to make money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's the endless cycle.
Thing upcoming for 2023 for you?
I'm going to work on a little project that should be, I can't say what it is, but it's a little collaboration with a friend that will be revisiting an older project that I'm very excited about, but I can't make it public just yet. But I'm just trying to get back to the book that I've been working on for 10 years, Building Race and Nation on American Civic Architecture, Slavery and Dispossession. And so I'm going to try to fly below the radar. For a little bit,
so you can
finish this work, yeah.
And then you can go on your book tour. And
I know if I had had this book done when Michelle Obama said, "I wake up in a house built by slaves," I would have my canon moment.
Oh man! Any celebrities that you've met?
Any celebrities
that you're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe I met you. That you were excited for.
Any celebrities that I have met recently?
This general, anything that pops in your head. Last question, I swear.
I don't know. In New York, it's like when you see a famous person, it's like
whatever. Yeah, okay.
Get out my way.
Right, I gotta go there.
You're taking up my space. I remember I used to, my first job in New York, I used to take the train to work. And ABC used to shoot a lot of soap operas. And so sometimes I would see these soap opera people adding pride into somebody. I'm like, move. get out of my way, you know, Phoebe from All My Children or something like that. But I did have this funny day where I went to a taping of the Wendy Williams show, because actually Wendy Williams was somebody I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
Her parents and my parents were really good friends. So I was just really curious, like, where did Wendy end up? What did she do? And it was like literally her last few shows, right? Because then she never came back. So after that, I had a meeting downtown and I was just kind of walking along and I'm like, is that Dave Chappelle? And sure enough was, he was sitting outside smoking a cigarette. And I'm like, whoa. And I was just like, I'm gonna leave the brother alone.
Right.
Let him do his thing. I'm not gonna go fangirl. But I was like, wow. And then I go to this restaurant, Odeon downtown, meet these people for lunch. And I'm like, that's Delroy Lindo. So it was like a trifecta of famous Black people day. So that was a memorable celebrity sighting day in New York City. But mostly it was just like people doing what people do.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. And thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. And it's a great series. So just happy to contribute.
Thanks. All right. Bye.
Bye. Take care.
Hey, listeners. I have an exciting announcement. I decided to launch a membership program for the show, where you have a chance to support me and the show directly. I love creating the show, and it means the world to me that you all tune in to keep hearing me week after week. But it takes an immense amount of time and energy to produce. I want to keep the show going, and I want to invest in its growth. And I also want you to become a partner with me in this journey. That's why I'm excited to give you a chance to officially become a supporter of the show at glow.fm/archispolly, A-R-C-H-I-S-P-O-L-L-Y, or by clicking the link in the show notes. It's quick and easy. It takes less than 30 seconds and just takes clicking a link in the show notes and using Apple or Google Pay. You don't have to create any new logins, and you can contribute as much or as little as you like. If this show is part of your day or week and you like what I'm doing, then visit glow.fm/archespoly, all one word, and support me and the show in any way you can today.